Session number 30059, Reel 6.
You might have got the ATO that I had about it. I don't remember. We kept getting more and more space and more and more space. Finally, we had the whole field, except for one small building that CCRC moved out of there completely. And one building was reserved for some VIP landing their airplane. I forgot, there was another side of the field. We never saw it. Once in a while, they come with a little help, start an engine start or something like that. But nothing to do with them. I would say that we started out with one large and one small hangar and two buildings, and wound up with everything on the field except one small hangar. We took over all of the mess and housing facilities, which were about a half a mile from the aerodrome. Such as they were, but as I moved out there, a year and a half out there, most of the time, in the mud.
The good old English mud.
Don't worry about that, Roger. I love the mud, if it was English.
Okay. Down at the bottom, below the illustrator, about the photo in the original bottom in group two, does that ring a bell with the three bomb symbols in the wheelbarrow with the two stars?
Sure. I forgot who it was. I carried them there. That was after we had run two missions with the group.
Field and for another reason and said take me up? Or
no. It was somebody connected with operations, and it must have been at Bomber Command. Because I had led three groups of missions. Those are the three bomb missions that were on there. The results had been evaluated, and as I recall, this Brass came and wanted to see for himself whether this was a project that should be made a major project for the 8th Air Force. And of course, there's some question about whether this was a Bomber Command project or whose project was it?
Yeah.
Because the P-38s all carried the bombs, two 2,000-pound bombs, one under each wing, and led by the group suit with its own bombs. And yet the targets were selected by Bomber Command, or at least by 8th Air Force, and the fighter. We provided our own fighter cover, and I think there was a big harangue at the 8th Air Force headquarters, just whose missions were these anyway?
Bombers or fighters?
Doolittle said, hell, they're my operational engineering section mission. That's what the they are. And anyway, I don't know who the general was.
He must not have been a big man if he was in that group's news. Unless you sat on his lap.
No. You what?
I said, unless you sat on his lap and flew him around, he must have been small enough to get, or slender enough to get in the...
Well, whoever it was, My records might show. I don't think so. Because it was such an everyday occurrence. People wanting, people coming from stateside, or people coming from Terreborn outfits like USAF and some of the others that wanted to see where the armies were in Normandy and that sort of thing. We were doing all these odd jobs for in addition to a regular job. So much so that Doolittle suggested one night when he had Ben and me for supper that our motto should be small job neatly done. And that's what we did. That was our motto from then on. Dave Schilling added another one, as I think I told you when we were once before, Millick Street in Taurus, which is lousy Latin, but conveys the idea. He said it's the only outfit I ever came in contact with that had any engineering ability that wasn't for a full ship. Hence the phrase Millick Street in Taurus. I said to Dave, that's pretty poor Latin. He said, I don't get what it's poor Latin or not.
Did they abuse, I suppose, the privilege of sending you people, take them up for a ride type of stuff? I mean, were there people always appearing on the doorstep that so-and-so sent me?
No, Doolittle told me that any time that they interfered with anything, they have to do it. But the people that, most of the people that, came out there looking for something like that, the people have had an interest in what we were doing. And the only one that I can recall that was strictly for publicity and was Will Rogers Jr. Came out there, and he came out, Doolittle phoned and said, you're going to have a congressman out there before long, and he wants a ride in your piggyback, P-38. He said, if you don't want to take him, say so. And I said, I'll send somebody along. He said, no, you won't. It's you or nobody else. Because he insisted, why would you? So I said, okay. Anyway, he came out, and he took the armor out of the back of the pilot seat and the P-38 and the radio, poked the radio equipment out. So just room in there to kind of sit in there. And he got in there, and I threw him over the front lines, and I said to him, you're going to need my armor plate, don't forget that. I hope you've got good, strong, big bones, because I've got guns in front, but I've got nothing protecting them in the back. Anyway, I threw him over the front lines, and he saw some bombing operations, and he saw some German fighters, and he saw us go like hell for home when the fighters got too numerous. And he then, the next day, appeared in the paper thing that Daisy had was, he claimed that he rode on my shoulders.
No.
That's what triggered him. He said he was over there, he'd been riding on my shoulders, sitting on my lap. He told about flying over the war zone, riding on my shoulders, what a courageous act it was. I like that guy. And Doolittle called me up and said, what do you mean riding on your shoulders? I said, no, you see my airplane. Yeah, you've got a little seat back there, but it's not very comfortable. And he said, well, General Arnold called me and said, what the hell are you doing over there with riding people riding on other people's shoulders? And I said, tell General Arnold, this is what I told you. The groupship and or the piggyback P-38. And he had a seat that was not on my shoulders.
Irresponsible choice of words.
Maybe I can find out who the general was.
Let's see. Unless you have further pages that I don't have on mine, we get to pictures. Any help there, Cass?
Well, Pat, I'll tell you, if I had read that more carefully, I would have tried to dig these things with you, but I haven't had time since I got this. It's only about a month.
Yeah.
And I've been in Arkansas most of that time, back and forth at least, and I know roughly where the majority of my pictures are, roughly. And it would just require a sorting job to find out, but I promise you I'll do it. I'll dig out some of these things.
What about Kozlowski?
They live up in the North Shore, up in the Panhandle, at a place called, believe it or not, I can never believe the name when I see it. Something like Field.
Or some other engineering establishment in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
They were both part of the 6th Pursuit Wing, Selfridge Field. And Kozlowski, their shape was assigned originally as my crew chief. And Kozlowski was the crew chief on some other airplane and a really smart young man. And so when they moved to England, I latched on to those two. Not the only two I had, as I said, for quite a little while. But they were both good tin benders, and good smart analysts. We had a trial that we worked really closely together, and he certainly should get some good press. And the Shaper's dad, of course.
Yes.
Staff Sergeant or Buck Sergeant or Staff Sergeant when I came to the Selfridge Field. Schaefer was a Tech Sergeant. And
is that Selfridge?
Selfridge Field, yeah. And I got the same time that I got Schaefer made a first lieutenant. And then after quickly after that, a captain. And then when Doolittle picked up the outfit and transferred it to 8th Air Force, he said, write your own TO. And I wrote rank in there to take care of Schaefer and Kozlowski. Kozlowski, in the meantime, had gone to a small OCS that they ran in the UK and got his gleaming gold bar. And I think he was a captain when the war ended, if I'm not mistaken.
What was his first name?
Walter. Yeah.
Walter. I haven't written it on.
They were both wartime promotions from the field. Both Taz went to the Shepherd, but went to the OCS. And then he just got promoted directly. But Taz, I think they had a 2-month OCS course, or 4 times OCS, somewhere in England. I forgot where. And I wanted him commissioned because I wanted them to have some rank that would give them the necessary authority to get things done.
They were pretty much your chief doers.
They were the doers. Oh, I had a number of doers. So Pat, doing begets doing.
Yeah.
And particularly in a war and wartime environment, and particularly with the latitude that we had. Wonderful thing. If we had constraints put on us, that Air Service Command would put on us, nothing would happen. We never would have the belly tanks for the P-47. Never in the world would we have. Nor would we have had the Disney bomb. Nor would we have had any of the troops that were done. All the things that we got that were a vital part of the war effort, never would have happened. That famous telegram, you know, the teleprompter that came back from right field after we dropped 14,000 belly tanks that said they're unfit for combat use. That, I think, epitomizes the situation. A lot of things did go wrong. It makes it not bad. And trying to get things done too quickly. Bypassing things sometimes that you know, cooler heads might have prevailed, but things had to end up single. Nothing disastrous, just a little things that we could have done better if we hadn't been so hurried. I think one of the times, Roger's got in this thing here, something that I made some notes on, but I can't find the notes.
Okay.
Roger, you're all screwed up on the belly, the extra fuel tanks for the P-47s. You're right at the first part where you say that the 200-gallon ferry tank was available and unsatisfactory. It was unsatisfactory for many reasons. Then you infer that the next thing was using 108-gallon tanks of some kind of a material. Actually, the material was paper, and that we got that idea from talking to a couple of Spitfire pilots who had been flying with the Desert Air Force and who had used paper tanks to drop water to troops or little areas full of troops in the desert. And I went down to Bowater Lloyd, paper people, somewhere along the Thames in London, to find out and to get some tanks from them and to find out if they put some extra wrappings of paper on them to make them hold fuel, and found out that we could. And those are the first things that we used. But we found, of course, then that we couldn't pressurize those tanks as highly as we wanted to anyway, because they might leak a little bit more. But the basic thing, as you point out, was devising a means of taking the bleed air from the vacuum pump and pressurizing the tank gradually as altitude increased. That was the first of you infer here that further, that was further experimentation, but the paper tank came first, and then came the means of pressurizing it. The development of the drop tank for the P-47, I have to believe, was one of the major contributions to the war effort, particularly in the air. And you point out, I think you're absolutely right. Well, I'll turn that off.
Okay.
The group suit, Roger, was. In the paragraph on page 5 of your text, it gives the impression, and I'm sure anybody who wasn't familiar would give the impression, that the Drupsnoot itself was going to do the bombing all by itself, whereas the Drupsnoot was conceived to be the lead aircraft of a bunch of fighters all carrying bombs, and the bombs carried by the Drupsnoot would be dropped, of course, as a signal for the others to drop when they saw the bombs go away. And I think that the paragraph on at the bottom of page 5 is not informative enough. Either mention it or mention it and tell what it did and how it did it, or don't talk about it at all, because this would leave anybody interested in an unsuccessful thirst for more information, which is not available here. You may recall, Roger, too, and you don't mention, maybe have someplace else you do, the fact that later on the states came up with, at my request, a radio control for the bombs, a little control put on every P-38 and also on the Drupsnoot, with the transmitting unit on the Drupsnoot, so that when the bombs went away on the Drupsnoot, it also triggered the bombs on the accompanying P-38s. each with a 2,000-pound bombs. It was only used on a couple of missions because it was late in the war when that finally came out. The rest, other time, though, the pilots themselves released the bomb when they saw the bombs go away from the group. On page 6, Roger, you're absolutely dead wrong about one thing in the last paragraph when you say that late in 44, Operation Engineering was redesignated as 8th Technical Operations, becoming an adjunct of 8th Air Force Service Command. We were never an adjunct of anybody. And if you're using the word adjunct in the sense of it being a complementary thing to Service Command, I suppose that's true. It meant that the Doolittle then had, as commander of the 8th Air Force, had an opportunity to call on all kinds of people, including us, to do these jobs. But we were never an adjunct of anything except the 8th Air Force. And then in that same thing I just told Pat, you treat that frontline marking device project so lightly that I can't believe it, Roger. It was one thing that enabled the breakout at St. Lo, as you know, and it was, despite having had some deadly effect on some of our own troops, was a highly successful thing, developed entirely by our outfit, and I think you missed the opportunity there of calling people's attention to the versatility of the people in our outfit and the great variety of things that we did. Here's something that was done just for the ground troops. Nothing to do with airplanes, really, except they were the vehicle that was used. Let me see if we'll stop at that.
What about bunker? What about bunker? You were going to talk about bunker.
Well, I did say early on that as maybe as related to higher to bunker's outfit, we were never an adjunct of it. We were complementary in a sense because I had no problems with Howard Bunker. Howard Bunker had no problems with me. He believed in what we were doing, and very often he was the one man that enabled us to get certain things done because of his help. Page 7, you're talking about one of the things that I was supposed to be in court-martialed for. Actually, the court was convened. But I think that's not the interesting part about it. The interesting part is why it was convened. And either it isn't important enough to talk about, or if it is important enough to talk about, then tell the whole story and not just leave people hanging. And I'll tell you the story, and you can decide what you want to do with it. Late on in the war, I guess along in the summer of 1944, thereabouts, we began to get in the theater fuel classified as 130/150 grade fuel. And a little higher in octane number and hence a little more performance from it. And in talking with Doolittle one day, I said to him, I think that we could very easily pull more power from that a Merlin engine with this new fuel. And Doolittle said, I think you're probably right. Well, you know, Jim Doolittle was a vice president in charge of aviation fuels for Shell in his civilian days and a very well-known authority on aviation fuels. And I thought, well, that reinforces my thinking about this considerably, although I did run a few tests on it and found that the only thing it did was over a period of time, I don't remember the number of hours, maybe 10 hours, 15 hours, 20 hours on an engine, 50 hours, I don't remember which, followed the plugs oftener. But because you could get the extra performance out of it, I thought it was worthwhile. So I teletyped each of the group commanders and told them that if any of their pilots got caught blind and needed extra performance for a few minutes not to hesitate to go through the gate on the throttle and to use this extra power from this new fuel. Well, I neglected to tell them that they probably would have a few more maintenance problems, but they wouldn't be major. But when they began to need a lot more spark plugs and called on Air Service Command to furnish more spark plugs for them, changing them oftener, Air Service Command wanted to find out why, and then they found out that they were using more power than was called for by the tech orders and so forth and so on, and that's where I got my you-know-what in the jam and was called to the carpet, and Air Service Command preferred charges against me. And who was my witness at this summary court? With none other but Jim Doolittle. He told him I was perfectly within my province to do this thing, and I was absolutely right that the war was on. It didn't make a difference. They had to use two or three times the number of spark plugs that were used, that there was no reason why it shouldn't stand just the way it was. Now, if you want to tell that story in your own inimitable way, go ahead and do it. Otherwise, I think it's a shame to just drop the thing the way you did it.